Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Hello, and welcome back to the Power Hour, the Heritage Foundation Center for Energy, Climate, and Environments podcast. I'm your host, Jack Spencer, and joining me today is none other than my favorite producer and yours, Mr. John Pop. John, how are you today?
I am well. How you hear me? Okay, from the basement?
Perfect. You sound great.
I love the basement.
Well, it's great to have you back on the regular. I'm glad everything's going good. So what's been keeping you busy this week?
Oh, appointments. Still dealing with this medical issue. So, but on the fun side, my daughter's about to give a big dissertation for her final paper down at school at UVA. So I'm going to go see that. And then she graduates in May. And Jack, she gets married in September.
Wow.
That's keeping us very busy.
That's a lot going on. Well, congratulations on all fronts, and hopefully that dissertation defense goes outstandingly well, which I'm sure it will.
Well, it better, because I said I was going to do a standing ovation, get up and just cheer and really try to embarrass her. That's what dads do.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, my daughter's on spring break this week, and in fact, I brought her and her mother, my wife, and her friend, her being my daughter's friend, to D.C. with me this morning. Oh. And they are out gallivanting around. It always adds an element of stress for me, man. I got to tell you, like, I have my routine. As you know, I live about 100 miles away, and I have my routine. I get up a certain time, do certain things to get ready, get out the door, and then I do my thing. And they are no burden at all. I'm happy to have them come with me. But oh my God, it makes me stressed out bringing them. Like, it's like another thing I need to think about, getting them to where they need to be, even though it's fine. But hopefully they're out there having fun, seeing monuments and seeing the good parts of D.C., of which there are few.
It's a beautiful day for that today, and I hope they have a fun time. So it's a great town to go be a tourist in.
They want to see the cherry blossoms, and I heard on the street, you know, I keep my ear close to the street.
Of course.
And they're gonna cut down all the cherry blossoms to renovate the tidal basin, I heard in a couple of years.
Well, what they're doing is they're pulling some of the trees out because the seawall is falling apart, but they're gonna plant those somewhere else, and then they're gonna replant more trees when they finish. So they're not going to cut them down. They would never. Oh, people would riot if they did that. So no, they're just going to pull them out, transplant them temporarily, and then put back even more trees when they're finished. But they need to pull back to build the seawall. Basically, the Jefferson Memorial is sinking into the Potomac, so they got to fix it.
Well, we can't have that, because for my money, Jefferson's about as good as they got.
There you go.
But. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What is both here and there, if it's neither here nor there, it's here and there. Anyway, is that we have a podcast to do. Now, I like to, at this point, we'll mention we have our housekeeping to do, which is primarily our email address, thepowerhour@heritage.org. Send me an email. Tell me what you want to hear or not hear. Let me know how we're doing, what we could do better. Or if you just want me to shut this thing down and not come back next week, let me know those things. And I will do my best to accommodate. That's the email address is thepowerhour@heritage.org. John, you want to tell people where they can find us?
Sure. Look on all your podcast feeds. You can just go to the internet and look up Heard at Heritage, The Power Hour. And you'll find it on Apple, Spotify, Ricochet, you name it. Google, it's everywhere. So, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast feed and you share it with your friends, because you'll get great stuff on there from Jack and other events here at Heritage.
Thank you, John. Now, John, you know me. As I just mentioned,
I do.
I alluded to just a moment ago. I like to keep my finger on the heartbeat of America's youth.
Right.
When I face a quandary, I often ask myself, what would Mr. Beast do? You know, you know that I am waiting with bated breath to see who Taylor Swift is going to endorse for president. And if you don't think that when I go home this evening that I won't be tuning in to the latest anime series, then you, my friend, are loopier than a coot. You heard me right. I have dupes on my feet, a mohawk fade on my head, future in my ears. I'm streaming Aiden Ross, and I'm hydrating with Prime. And you know what? That's how I do public policy. I want to know what the kids are thinking. Well, at least what the younger folks are thinking.
Them kids. Some crazy kids.
All kidding aside. Oh, man, this show's too much fun. All kidding aside, I think changing attitudes of young people towards nuclear energy is key to the technology moving forward. I want to know if Chernobyl, China Syndrome, and radioactive monsters still animate people's perception of nuclear energy. Well, you'll never guess what, John.
What?
We actually have someone with us here today who knows this stuff.
Ah.
She doesn't just know it. She is literally vice president at the North American Young Generation in Nuclear. If anyone knows what the kids be thinking, it's our guest today. I'm extremely happy to introduce to the Power Hour audience, Christine Fletcher. Christine, welcome to the Power Hour.
Awesome. Pleasure, Jack. No pressure, you know.
Never.
There's no pressure here. This is an informal, friendly conversation. I promise you. Anyway, John, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, I was going to say, Jack never does a build-up for the guests. It just never happens. So it's right. So laid back.
So I hope, Christine, that didn't catch you off guard. But anyway, I wasn't being hyperbolic. I am very excited to talk to you today. And I do think it's incredibly important what the changing attitudes of everyone about nuclear energy, including younger folks. And I think there are a lot of interesting social dynamics and cultural dynamics that are feeding into that. And I look forward to the conversation. I think it'll be good. But before we get in,
I'll
go ahead.
I agree. I'm looking forward to it as well.
Before we get into that, though, I want to talk a little bit about you. Like, who are you? How did you get to where you are? Some things about your career. So I'm going to start off real simple. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up just outside of Charleston, South Carolina, for those who know the area, Somerville. Went to college at Clemson University there in South Carolina, got my first job, moved to Atlanta, and I've been with that first job ever since, so right on 10 years now.
Outstanding. So how did you get into the nuclear business?
Well, it started with mechanical engineering. I saw the movie Iron Man when I was still in school, and I was like, that's pretty cool. I think I want to be a mechanical engineer. So that I was good at math and science, knew I could do it. So that's kind of what got me into mechanical. But I had no idea what I wanted to do with that degree until I got to be a senior at Clemson. And then, you know, actually had to start thinking about my job. I interviewed with the company that I'm with now. And I remember making a statement that, oh, yeah, nuclear is on the cutting edge. And at the time, back before we got into all the fun talk that we're going to talk with advanced SMRs and things like that, My interviewer looked at me and was like, oh, no, if you're looking into cutting edge, nuclear is not for you. And I remember being surprised by that. And he was right at the time, but it's been amazing how far nuclear has come in the last 10 years. And I could say now that if I was being interviewed today, he would not make that statement.
Now, let me ask you, I know that you're here representing NAGYN. How do you pronounce that, by the way?
We spell it out every time. Some people have said Nagin, but no, it is truly N-A-Y-G-N. It's a mouthful, but yeah, we just say all the letters.
All right. That's what I thought, but, you know, I was just curious. So I know you're representing N-A-Y-G-N today, but can you tell us a little bit about your day job? I don't know if you don't need to name the company or anything. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but just give us a sense of the sort of work that you do on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. So I specialize in what I guess the industry might call minor mods. These are mods that the plants need, like, to keep running on a day-to-day basis. So it's anything from replacing pumps that are just old and they need to be replaced, to valves, to heat exchangers, to compressors. I mean, all the common stuff you think of with any power plant, not just nuclear. That's what I do as a mechanical engineer. So a lot of times I, you know, start my day, I, like everyone, I've got half a day full of meetings. I'm a project engineer, so I'm leading teams through the different steps of the design process for nuclear, which, if you've ever been in the industry, it's very proceduralized, pretty rigid in how we do designs. But that's intentional, right? It's to make sure that we get it right, that people are evaluating everything that needs to be evaluated when it comes to making a change in a nuclear power plant. And I love it. It fits my personality really well. I love the mix of going out and looking at the field, talking to people about what the problem is and how to solve it. I really, you know, I think a lot of people go to school and they don't necessarily get to use their degree. And I would say that I truly feel like a mechanical engineer, like I get to do it every day.
Is your job, I'm going to use the word easy. I don't mean easy as in simple, but one of the critiques that are out there of nuclear energy is that the regulatory burden is so difficult to deal with. The regulators are always a pain. Is your job easy in those terms? Like, I understand there's a need for regulation. I'm not presupposing an answer. In fact, I would love it if you said, no, you know, there's appropriate oversight, but we're able to do our job. I'm curious sort of what's the red tape burden on something like that, where you're out making so-called minor modifications to something as heavily regulated as a nuclear power plant?
Sure. I would say it's medium difficulty, for maybe not the reason that people would think. The hardest part for anybody who's new to nuclear is the number of procedures. That there is literally a procedure for everything. So a lot of times when we've got people just starting with us and they're new to the industry, they'll come to me with a question and they'll say, hey, I don't know how to do this. And rather than try to answer the question, our first response is always, well, did you read the procedure? And inevitably they say, I didn't know there was a procedure for something like this. And we'll be like, oh yeah, no, there's definitely a procedure. So go read the procedure, see if that answers your question, and then come back. Just the sheer number of procedures, you know, a lot of people don't like being that restricted in how you handle things, but the procedures are there for a reason. They're a great way to document, hey, things went wrong, we need to do better. How do we make sure we always do better in the future? That's where the procedures come in. So once you've got a handle that, once you overcome that kind of upfront learning curve, then I would say it does get easy. I mean, you know the procedures, you know where they are, you've followed them 1,000 times. So yeah, it gets much easier after that first, 3 years or so.
Yeah, I know. You know, I've had the opportunity to visit, you know, any number of nuclear power plants and nuclear facilities really throughout the fuel cycle and actually around the world. But I will say that the safety culture of nuclear energy is always front and center. Like, anyone who is concerned about the safety aspects of nuclear need only spend a day at a nuclear power plant and see how seriously these things that you're talking about are taken to make them feel safe and secure in the underlying technology. I've always just been tremendously impressed. And though I've been a critic of government policy and I think they make it too hard to build power plants and bring new technologies to market, I've actually always been pretty complimentary of the symbiotic approach to regulation we have in American nuclear power, where you have a government regulator, you have strong private regulation, and you have strong incentives across the board. The incentives are properly aligned to maintain safe operations in the United States, more so really than any place else, where a lot of folks don't realize that the person who is in charge at a nuclear power plant has not just the freedom to, but the responsibility to shut that thing down at any point without asking anyone if anything's going wrong at all. Like, they shut that thing down right now, and they have the authority to do that. And that's part of that safety culture that runs through.
I granted, I haven't ever worked in an industry outside of nuclear, but talking with friends, I mean, that's pretty unheard of in all the other industries about just like you said, how much safety is emphasized. Safety of the people at the plant, safety for the general public. Safety is always on everyone's mind all the time.
Now I want to get back to, before we get into nuclear issues and what the kids be thinking, I want to talk about NAG Wine a little bit. How did you get involved with them and who are they? What do they do? That sort of thing.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit and we are actually all volunteers. So none of us get paid for the positions that we hold. And that's great most of the time because you are dealing with people who are truly passionate about nuclear energy and talking with others about the many benefits of nuclear. So we are kind of two main things that we focus on, and that is the professional development of our members, developing the future leaders of the nuclear industry for both today and tomorrow, as well as that educational aspect. So going into schools, talking with the general public about nuclear, dispelling myths. You know, there's a lot of myths about nuclear that have been propagated over time with the media and all that. So we just provide that professional development aspect as well as the educational aspect. I got involved with NAYGN shortly after I joined the nuclear industry. I went to a conference. I didn't know anything about it, but they had an extra spot. So I got to attend and I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that all these people were super passionate about nuclear. At the time, I was still relatively new. And I knew that when I joined nuclear, it was going to be a good fit because I always wanted to do something that I considered meaningful with my degree. And, clean source of energy seemed like a great way to do that. But I didn't realize how many other people shared that passion. So I went to my first conference, loved it, signed up to be on the government outreach committee, volunteered there for a few years, eventually ran that committee. And then I really had a step change in terms of my involvement. Oh, 3 years ago at this point, we had there was a global clean energy ministerial. It's a conference. It's all over the world, changes location every year, but it was in Pittsburgh in 2022. And I got to lead the delivery team for that. And we basically, nuclear at this conference was never talked about. It's not that it was talked about necessarily in a bad way, just wasn't talked about at all. And for something calling itself the clean energy ministerial, we were like, this is an opportunity. They're in the U.S. They're in our own backyard. We should go. So I led the team. We did a number of initiatives to make sure that nuclear was known at that conference, and it was a huge success. I would say that everybody by the end knew that nuclear had attended that conference. We got a lot of questions about nuclear. It was great. And I realized that I loved organizing that effort and organizing that team and working with really passionate volunteers. So that's what drove me to run for vice president of NAYGN, and I won the election, which was phenomenal, got a lot of support from people in the industry. And so I basically signed up for a three-year term. I'll do a year as vice president, a year as president, and then a year as past president. And then I will go on my way, and you know, the future is bright. I haven't decided what I'm going to do next because I still have 2 years ahead of me. But yeah, that's how I got involved with NAYGN.
That's awesome. Now, we had Matthew Maringer on here about a month ago, and he was awesome as well. So we love the work that NAYGN does, and we hope to have you all on in the future as well. That's interesting that a Pittsburgh clean energy conference wouldn't have just organically been built around nuclear, because a lot of people don't, I guess, realize that Pittsburgh really has played such an important role in American commercial nuclear power historically. And really, there's not a better place to talk commercial nuclear and the role of nuclear than Pittsburgh.
Yep, that's exactly what we thought. So we wanted to capitalize on it when we heard it was going to be there.
So let's talk about people's perception of nuclear and why, if it's changing, how it's changing, why it's changing. So I guess I'll start with the easy question. Is the perception of nuclear power changing among Americans and also younger Americans more specifically?
Yes, I would say so. And a couple studies I think would agree with me to give you a few numbers. About 50% of people 18 to 34 support nuclear. Another study had that as high as 80%, which is great. And millennials were actually the strongest pro-nuclear group, about 34% of millennials are strong pro-nuclear believers. So the younger generation is definitely coming around and believing in nuclear.
Why do you think that is? Do you have any insights on that?
I think we're starting to see the effects of years of advocacy starting to take effect. So groups like NAYGN, groups like ANS, the American Nuclear Society, WIN, Women in Nuclear. I mean, we've been doing this for over a decade, right? Like, we've been talking with the general public. We've been going into schools. And I think we're finally starting to see the fruits of our labor. So to give you an example of some of the things that NAYGN does, we've written and published our own children's books. The first one, Marie's Electric Adventure, was huge. We went into so many schools reading that. We had so many requests for that book. That was great. We hosted essay contests for high school students, a drawing contest for elementary school students. And in all, we've got about 150 chapters across North America. Because at the end of the day, NAYGN is a grassroots organization. So we at the continental level, like myself as vice president, I exist to support our chapters and what they're doing. If they want to host a chili cook-off and invite the public to come, like, I am there to support them and help organize that event. So the chapters do anything and everything to support their members and to engage with the public. And it's really fun to see all the ways that we've reached out over the years.
One of the interesting cultural aspects of this, I think, is or societal aspects, I guess, the cultural imprint that Three Mile Island and Chernobyl had on the United States and just for nuclear in general for a long time. And, you know, coming at around the same time as the China syndrome and growing out of, you know, this unfortunate conflation of nuclear weapons with nuclear power. You just had all of these things that really created this massive headwind against the perception of nuclear energy. And so much popular media followed that lead with, you know, the tropes of green, mucky fuel waste and The Simpsons and all the rest of it. And it really feels like the industry has begun overcoming all of that to the point that even some of the more recent efforts to tap into that same anti-nuclear phenomena just doesn't really have the same impact as it used to. You know, things like, you know, there are different Netflix series and different whatever seem to not really have the same impact that they once did. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like, have we just moved far enough away from those things that that they don't sting like they did? Or is it because of groups like NAYGN? Or what's the deal? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think time definitely plays a part. But I also think people are just a little more skeptical of just like believing, like if they hear, oh, nuclear is bad, here's an accident. Like, sure, but I think they are doing their own research more so than in the past, right? And so as soon as you start Googling nuclear power, you start to see all the benefits that pop up and not so much the criticisms that you might hear, like if you were talking to somebody in person. And if you did start to do a deep dive on some of the dangers of nuclear, you start to see like, oh, I don't know that that's true. To give you an example of some of the stuff you'll see if you Google nuclear power, you're going to see some really cool facts, things like, oh, one fuel pellet contains the same energy as one ton of coal. I mean, it just shows how energy dense uranium is and how, you know, we can really reduce how much fuel we need. And then another fact that I like to give people, you know, when they're first starting out and kind of, oh, is this good? Is this bad? Like every year in the U.S., nuclear plants that the U.S. has, we've got about just less than 100 operating plants. They prevent more than 470 million metric tons of CO2 that would otherwise have come from fossil fuels. And I know that number doesn't mean anything to anybody. It didn't to me. But that's basically the same as taking 100 million cars off the road. And it's just fact after fact like that. If you do that Google search and you're looking at nuclear power, you're going to see all the benefits far outweigh some of the history of these accidents. And even if you did do a deep dive into these accidents, I think that people, you know, yes, they were terrible, but I don't know that they are as terrible as like when you first think about a nuclear accident. to put some numbers to it, let's talk Chernobyl. You know, by far and away the worst nuclear accident. About 30 people passed away within 3 months, and about 4,000 have an increased risk of cancer. Not to say that they got cancer, they have an increased risk. So as terrible as Chernobyl was, and as, you know, defining of a generation as that event was with the nuclear industry, it wasn't as bad as maybe people first think. Take Three Mile Island. The impact of the radiation release, it couldn't even be measured. So, I mean, Three Mile Island, like, at the end of the day, it wasn't an accident like even Chernobyl. And then most recently, take Fukushima. I think one person passed away about a few years later from their exposure to radiation. I mean, obviously that disaster was catastrophic. I mean, 20,000 people died as a result of the earthquake and the evacuation. But if you look at the radiation exposure, it's not just like radiation was thrown all over and people were being exposed to this. So I think when people do those deep dives into those accidents, they're starting to see, you know, a slightly different narrative than people thought of these accidents in the past. And just to end on one more thing with Fukushima, I think most recently in the news, they were talking about the tritiated water releases into the ocean, and that got a lot of attention. And, oh my gosh, we're contaminating the ocean. But again, to help people understand the level of radiation we're talking about, if you drank 100 gallons of that water being released by Fukushima, you'd receive the same dose as if you ate about 14 bananas. And I don't think anyone's worried about eating 14 bananas. So that just goes to show it gets put in perspective, and I think people are understanding that these days better than they ever have before.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, with Chernobyl, I mean, I don't even like talking about Chernobyl in terms of, you know, TMI or even Fukushima, because it was such a different situation where you had, you know, the Russian military taking over a testing of a reactor that can't even be built in the United States, wasn't properly, you know, there weren't proper protections in place. They were running it in a way that it was never meant to be run. And then there's people that died. Most of them died not because they weren't adequately protected, but because they weren't even told they were going into a radioactive environment. I mean, it's just the Chernobyl thing is just a complete, a complete utter debacle. That says far more about the dangers of communism than it does the dangers of nuclear energy. Fukushima, I think, is really interesting in the broader context of what we're talking about, because it really hasn't had any cultural impact, really. I don't think that most people, when we talk about nuclear energy, we're not bringing up Fukushima as the reason not to do it. And, you know, it's because precisely what you said, not to downplay the seriousness of the accident. That accident probably shouldn't have occurred the way it did. However, the radiological impact is just nothing like what we were told it was going to be. And you start reading reports now from officials on the ground who basically say the only reason we're still doing cleanup is not because there's any more significant radiological contamination, but because we're expected to do so. And if anyone is ever going to move back to some of these areas, we have to keep doing this. But it's not because there's a public health or safety concern. So I totally agree with you. I think that it's clear to everyone we've been sold a bill of goods on the supposed safety risks of nuclear. But I'll also say a lot of the reason that we're in this situation where the safety record is so strong is because of people like yourself in the industry who take safety so seriously. They respect the technology, unlike what those Russian guys did.
It's funny you mentioned that, and that's something when I first started my career, the nuclear industry was probably impacted way more than Fukushima than the general public. Because when I first started, we were right in the middle of what we call flex strategies. And it was basically the U.S. spending billions of dollars on safety measures to make sure that an accident like Fukushima, you know, wouldn't happen here. And it's crazy the amount of safety measures that were added on top of the existing safety measures because of Fukushima.
Yeah, no, I was talking about the cultural impact. Yeah, definitely Well, you just said, I don't need to say it again. There was certainly an industry impact. And we don't need to get into the details of it because that's not what we're here to talk about today. But I think that that is an interesting discussion to have as well when talking about how sometimes regulators respond to certain things. It's not that we shouldn't have had any response to what happened in Fukushima. We should have. But sometimes back when Fukushima happened, many were acting as if the United States nuclear industry was equally vulnerable to what happened in Fukushima as the Japanese nuclear industry, and it just simply was not. But anyway, that's a different conversation for a different day, and I didn't ask you to come talk about that controversial issue, so I won't, I promise. One thing I do want to ask you about, and this might be more controversial, and we might disagree on this particular issue, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. You mentioned the climate benefits of nuclear energy. I think that that's a dangerous wagon to hook nuclear energy so exclusively to. And I feel like that's what's happened in recent years. And the reason for that is I believe that nuclear energy provides so much more than that. And that the climate benefits of nuclear energy, certainly nuclear energy is CO2. Emits less CO2, but I don't know that, you know, when you use the truth is when you use EPA climate models and the IPCC climate models, you're going to have, I mean, the United States can stop emitting CO2, all CO2 tomorrow, and has virtually no impact on climate over the next, you know, 100 years. And I'm not bringing this up to debate climate. I'm bringing it up because as we go down this road, some of the economic factors around a so-called transition from hydrocarbons to alternatives are going to make it really difficult to do that. And given, I just don't know that you get the tangible environmental benefit that sometimes we're told that we're going to get from that transition. And that could create a backlash towards the transition, which could put nuclear energy back to where it started. And not because it doesn't bring so many other benefits, but because the CO2 benefits won't be as important as what they were portrayed as. Does that make sense? I'm not asking if you agree with the underlying premise of my question, but do you understand where I'm coming from?
Sure. And I think that's a fair concern. Climate change is a hot topic today. A lot of industries, including nuclear, are capitalizing on that. And if that was the only thing that, you know, oh, nuclear solves climate change, then yeah, I would be concerned as well. But I do think nuclear offers more than just, oh, it prevents CO2, more than just the climate change aspect. Nuclear does offer more. And so because it offers more, like, you know, I believe in nuclear, whether or not climate change stays around as a hot topic like it is today, I think nuclear can still stand on its own.
But will people's openness to nuclear remain as positive as it is today? Because I think climate change, as people who have advocated for an energy transition, they've had to reconcile the fact that wind and solar can't meet the energy requirements of a modern industrial society. The only way to fill that gap in a carbon-free way is nuclear. And that has opened people's minds and hearts up to nuclear that might not otherwise have been open. So if the CO2 thing goes away, does that support go away?
I think there's two other things. So let's forget the climate aspect and talk about two other reasons why, like, nuclear is great. The first is energy security, right? So as we've seen with the war in Ukraine, you never want all your eggs in one basket for your energy profile. And right now, the U.S. is heavily invested in natural gas and coal. That's, I think, 60% roughly of our energy infrastructure. And nuclear is coming in at just under 20%. So ideally, we want to be more balanced. And I've got a couple of things for where our uranium is even currently coming from. So right now, Canada provided in 2022 about 27% of our uranium. Kazakhstan provided 25%. So that's half of our uranium is not even coming within the U.S. So if we want nuclear to provide that energy security, we need to take a hard look at that. And luckily, back in 2019, President Trump was concerned with that. He formed the Nuclear Fuel Working Group, which eventually translated into the DOE's the Strategy to Restore American Nuclear Energy Leadership, which is a really wordy way to say, yes, we need to revive our uranium mining capabilities. We need to restore U.S. technology supremacy. And so we're starting to see the fruits of that. In 2024, we're going to have three new uranium mines up and running. They're scheduled to be up and running by the end of 2024. So if we can balance out where our energy is coming from, that's just going to increase our energy independence as well as our energy security. But the other big one, and this is one of my favorite things to talk about with nuclear, is the jobs that are created. So in addition to the energy security, the creating the jobs. So right now, we talked about how there's just fewer than 100 plants operating in the U.S. today. That's nearly 500,000 jobs. That is about $60 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product from nuclear. So it is generating a lot of money, right? Nuclear plants can hire up to 700 employees. I think that checks out. You know, nuclear is doing a lot. It's a pretty complicated technology, so that makes sense that we need a lot of workers. Fortunately, these salaries are about 30% higher than the local average. So it's a lot of jobs, and they are good-paying jobs. And then, again, just to emphasize the financial aspect, nuclear plants contribute billions of dollars annually to local economies through federal and state taxes. So nuclear is doing a lot besides, you know, like you said, forget the climate aspect. Are there other benefits to nuclear? And I would say the answer is definitely yes.
I agree with those things. And that's why I'm optimistic. One of the things that I wanted to mention to you, I'm glad that you brought up the jobs, is that something that that younger folks are starting to gravitate towards? And could you talk about the kinds of jobs that are in the nuclear field? Because I think so often we think about, you know, people in white coats doing like science stuff, and certainly that's part of it. But there's like a whole bunch of other things in nuclear. What are younger folks starting to look at nuclear across that career spectrum as career options?
Yeah, we're starting to see people with all kinds of backgrounds starting to join the nuclear industry. Like, I've talked to people, I had an old supervisor, he used to be in radio. So he eventually got a degree in chemical engineering. There's people today that came from broadcasting, criminal justice, sociology, forestry, meteorology, they all have come to nuclear. And that's, they can do that, I think, because we talked about procedures earlier. But another great thing that the nuclear industry does is the training that they provide. You will be fully prepared to do the job that you need to do at a nuclear plant, and they will make sure that you receive that training. You know, if you've been in it for as long as some people have, you know, maybe training is the worst part of the job. But all things aside, no, you'll definitely receive the training you need, even if you're coming from an industry that has no direct tie to power generation. If you are, there's definitely, you know, trades that we need in addition to, you know, some of these others that, you know, you're welcome to join the industry. But people we really need right now are some of the skilled trades, right? So electricians, masons, pipe fitters, welders, heavy equipment operators. Like, I think those would probably be pretty obvious. And any power generation is going to need that, not just nuclear. But that's some of the skilled trades. So that's not a PhD engineer by any stretch of the imagination. And then some of the other like side professionals we need, like cybersecurity. Cyber is really big in nuclear right now. It's, you know, nuclear lagged a little bit behind for a number of years. Avoided, the way they dealt with cybersecurity was just to not install anything cyber in the plant, and then you couldn't be hacked. That's not a long-term solution, and then the industry has realized that. So we're coming up to speed with cyber components, cybersecurity. But we need accountants, policy analysts, communications. I mean, pretty much any job out there, it either has a direct tie to nuclear or, like I said, we provide the training you need to be successful in the nuclear industry.
Let me ask, we're sort of coming up on the end here. There was something I wanted to ask you about to get your opinion on. When I look at nuclear policy, there are two areas that I think really are antiquated, if not just outright obsolete, and have been really barriers to the long-term future success, I would argue, of the industry, and that's around waste and regulation. I think in both cases, we're stuck in the 1970s. I'm wondering if young folks' openness to nuclear energy and their willingness to rethink what their parents have been told about nuclear could lead to breakthroughs in how we deal with nuclear waste or spent nuclear fuel and on how we regulate nuclear power.
Yeah, let's talk about the waste first, because that's the most common question we get asked when we're out doing advocacy is, what about the waste? And my favorite response, a friend told me this, my favorite response when I get asked that question is, well, what about the waste? It's safely stored on site. My favorite fact when talking about waste is actually all of the U.S. spent fuel for the last 70 years, for 100 or so plants being in operation, would fit on a football field 10 yards high. And I say that fact because I think it opens people's eyes to how little waste there actually is to be worried about. It would fit on a football field. But yeah, we know where all the spent fuel is. I don't think any other industry could say the same. And of the total volume of nuclear waste, only 3% is this high-level waste that we really need to be worried about for, you know, long-term. And there's two permanent solutions to that, because what we just talked about, you know, it's a cool fact, but right, that's not a permanent solution. The first is reprocessing. By the time uranium has been in the core for 5 years, it still has more than 90% of its potential energy. So we're doing a lot of work with reprocessing. France has a plant up and running that runs on 100% recycled uranium. So the technology is there. It can be done. The U.S. isn't doing that right now just because it comes down to money. Honestly, it's cheaper to mine more uranium than it is to reprocess uranium. But if that ever did become like a huge sticking point, I mean, the technology is there. It can be done. The other way, if you don't want to reprocess it, you can store it. So Finland has a deep geological repository. It's 1,500 feet below ground, and they've come up with a method that they could safely store that waste for 100,000 years. So reprocessing, storing it long-term, deep underground, those are two options, you know, permanent solutions to that question, what about the waste?
Outstanding. And I can't mention waste without putting in my two cents, which is probably some combination of both of those are the way to go forward. And this is just my opinion. I'm not putting it on anyone else. The government's the wrong entity to do it. It's proven itself incapable of taking on that responsibility. They probably should have never had it to begin with. And that's why I'm hoping new thinking about waste can really drive new approaches to policy. Christine, we're out of time. That was great. I know our listeners will have found it useful. I hope that you did as well. I want to thank everyone who took some time out of your day to listen to the Power Hour. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends and family and colleagues to check us out. Email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Now, before we end, Christine, I need to give you the opportunity to say the last word. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like to add? Anything like that? What do you have coming up? Are you on like social media? Where can people find all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, NAOIGN is definitely on social media. You can search us on all the major platforms, North American, Young Generation, and Nuclear. If you are a supporter of nuclear, if you were before this, or if you are now after hearing this, I'll end on an ask. So we always want people to support the nuclear industry. So call your congressman and say, hey, I believe in nuclear, and I want you to support nuclear energy too. That goes a long way towards letting them know that this is what you believe in, and this is what you want to see in your future. So it was a pleasure talking with you all today. And yeah, please support the nuclear industry.
Awesome. Thank you, Christine. John, do you have any final words?
Yes, I do, Jack. For regular listeners, what do you like more, nuclear or coal? Because I'm thinking you're starting to tilt back towards nuclear.
I am not. I am agnostic on all energy sources. I think they should all compete fairly in the marketplace. And my objective when it comes to nuclear is to make sure it can compete fairly, which I would argue for any number of policy reasons, it cannot. And I just happen to also think nuclear has more potential than I can account for, and that we make it more difficult than it needs to be for that technology to move forward is something we need to change. That's what I would say for myself.
Amen. I agree.
So there you go, folks. Remember to email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Thank you, John and Christine Fletcher. Thank you for being a guest. Most importantly, thank all of you for listening. We'll see you next time.